He was born into a staunch Lutheran family. He grew up in the Lutheran church. He went through the college system, coming from an aristocratic family. His father was a very successful merchant, making his initial money in selling clothier, but then also got into grocery business, selling food commodities in the Copenhagen area. But he went to the university, was a very successful student, very precocious, and even decided to study to become a Lutheran pastor, and went through, completed his degree, was certified, equivalent of that, but never accepted a call and never became ordained. So he talked of himself from those days on as one speaking without authority. And Fred Craddock, as some of you have read, one of the premier teachers in America on the art of preaching, has a book called Without Authority. He also has another book on Kierkegaard called Overhearing the Gospel. He's very much committed to insights from Kierkegaard. But anyway, so that's kind of, and then he ended up being pretty much a gad about the town in Copenhagen, and started in 1838, his great writing career that lasted till 1855 when he died. He wrote right up to the end of his death. In those years, those 17 years, he wrote some 25 books, which most of those books are utterly profound pieces. It's incredible that a person could write that much, that short time, and so many of the books be utterly profound. One of the books, the big book, the concluding unscientific postscript to the Philosophical Fragments, is his classic, and it's a work in philosophy. But all of his books have a tremendous profundity to them. In addition to that, he wrote, in the English translation, a 4,000-page journal. And of those books, the 25 books that he wrote nearly half of them under pseudonyms. And he was very serious about his pseudonyms. The thing I want to mention about that briefly is that it complicates the authorship. Because he said in his journals that if you want to know what I think, you should read my journals and not read my synonymous authorship, the books that I've written under pseudonyms, because they're not really me. And a tremendous amount of ink has been spilled over trying to understand his synonymous literature, why he wrote books under pseudonyms, what kind of a game was this man playing, or what kind of profound insight was he uncovering through that procedure. At any rate, that's another feature that talks a little bit about the complexity of what he produced in that short period of time. Britta Stendhal, some of you know her by her famous wife, Krister, her famous husband, Krister Stendhal. But she's written a little book on Kierkegaard, and in that she does a nice job summarizing the four crises in his life. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about that, and then we'll get to looking at some of his actual writings. His first crisis was with his father. His father, Michael, was a very severe Lutheran. And he lived under the tutelage of his father and admired him immensely and hated him severely as well. And he never got over his father. Garrison Keillor, in one of the monologues that I like the best, it's the Job sermon that some of you may have heard. At the end of that thing, his punchline is, when life's over, it's going to take us a long time to get over it. When life finally comes to an end, it's going to take us a long time to get over it. Kierkegaard never got over his father. Okay? And it was this, and some, Kierkegaard is known as the Jury Dane. I think it's a misnomer, but he's known as the Jury Dane, the Melancholy Dane. And they say he acquired that from his father. His father was a very brooding, melancholy sort. And very severe disciplinarian. He would keep Soren kind of locked up in the house, and they would go on trips in the living room all over the world. They'd walk around the living room together, and he would demand that Soren would describe the countryside of wherever they were traveling. This kind of a bizarre abuse, psychological abuse at him. And so anyway, that was one of his crises. The second crisis was his engagement to Regina Olsen, which he finally broke off. And he talked a lot about why he could not finally go along with the plans to marry. And There's all kinds of theories on why he did not marry, ranging all the way from that he was trying to protect her because he knew he would end up psychologically massacring her in the relationship because he was such an arduous person for his life, ranging from that kind of concern for her all the way to that he was a homosexual. Okay. And the final word on it is his word in his journal. He said, "I will go to my grave with that secret. No one will know why I never married Regina." So that was a big crisis in his life. His third crisis was with a comic newspaper in Copenhagen called the Corsair, edited by a Goldschmidt, who had been a very good friend of his, and they turned on each other in the middle 40s, 1845 to 1850, and got into this vitriolic exchange in the newspapers. And from that time, there are a lot of cartoons that emerged of Kierkegaard on what a jerk he was. And part of the reason for the exchange was that Kierkegaard is very critical of Copenhagen as not living up to its great heritage. But that was a crisis for him because he suffered social ignominy. He was regarded as an undesirable in Copenhagen, even though here he was from a wealthy family, highly educated, author of these tremendous books, so on. The last crisis in his life is where we're going to be looking at most of it, and that was his fight with the established church, the church which he loved. Hal Lindsey, which all of you read, I know Hal Lindsey, his book on Satan, he has the 8 satanic bombs that have hit the modern world, and one of them is Søren Kierkegaard. And the reason that Hal Lindsey says Kierkegaard is one of the satanic bombs that is destroying the modern world is because of his attack on the Christian faith. It's very important to see that Kierkegaard did not attack the Christian faith, but attacked the church that peddled it. Kierkegaard said in his journals, we'll look at this passage, "In heaven, pastors will be what prostitutes were on earth." He was very distressed with the way the church was peddling the Christian faith. But he was tremendously respectful and touched to the heart by the Christian faith itself. So Lindsey misses it. Not surprising, is it? He misses it. The distinction between the Christian faith and Christendom, or the way the church peddles the Christian faith. In that last period, he has this attack on the established church, and it happens through an attack on the bishops. Do we have any bishops in here? I knew there was. I saw a bishop wandering around here, but anyway, he was afraid to come. Yeah, Bishop Munster, and then when Munster died, Martinson became bishop, and Martinson should have been a good bishop, but when he got the office, he went to hell. Martinson was a teacher. He knew theology. He knew the grammar of the faith. But when he became a bishop, he went to hell. So Kierkegaard took him on too. And those are the last years of his life. 1850, 1855, he attacked the church. And that, some say, was the most heartrending crisis in his life. Worse than the thing with his father and the broken engagement with Regina and the public humility with the Corsair. The worst crisis in his life was at the end when he attacked the church because he loved it more than any of the others. He loved it so dearly. Okay, that's kind of the period where we're going to look. I find that period of him just to be utterly exhilarating. 1850 to 1855. I doubt that, but I'd like to. I'd say something about that.
What's going on here? That
yeah.
Goes almost to nothing, and then
yeah.
Has to come back. And
well, I think Kierkegaard's a hot potato, you know, and he never really sit with that hot potato. You're always tossing it at somebody. Okay. In this century, it's largely through Karl Barth's commentary on Romans that Kierkegaard hit the theological world. Howard Hong says that Kierkegaard really wasn't known until 100 years after he died. In like at 1950, you know, the work started being translated. This man wrote in his own native language in a country of about 2 or 3 million. That'd be like the state of Washington having its own language, and here you are, right? He did not write in the world languages. He'd write French or German. So this stuff was kind of locked into this. Anyway, so then it hits in the 50s, 40s, 50s, and Martin Heineken tells a story that Kierkegaard is great if you need an enema. But if you're not constipated, don't read him. So maybe the reason he comes and goes, Chuck, is because our constipation comes and goes. All right? I don't know. Karl Barth wrote of Kierkegaard when he received a prize in Copenhagen for contribution to Danish culture because of the Roman brief.
We need him when we're doing church mergers and putting
together. My story will be we need him every day, whether you're constipated or not. See? But Barth said, every Christian who doesn't pass through the school of Kierkegaard does it at his own peril. Then he says, but once you pass through it, you're nuts if you ever go back. Okay? So he's a hot potato. Barth, really knew him, knew his thought well, and captured tremendous insights of his, but he left him. See, it's something you pass through. So come and go, maybe new generations. If Barth's right, then a new generation comes up, they need to pass through the school of Kierkegaard, but then, for God's sake, don't go back to it, and you wait for the next generation. Or it could be Heineken's interpretation, in other words, you're constipated, and you need a laxative, and Kierkegaard's the laxative. I don't know why. I just think he's a hot potato. I think he's very difficult to read because it hurts. It hurts to read him. There's a new book out published last year, Louisiana State University Press, by a wonderful Kierkegaard scholar named Naomi Leibowitz. And in her preface of that book, she has this wonderful line. She says, if you're going to feel the spirituality, the Christian spirituality of Kierkegaard, you must experience him literarily. There's something in the very reading of his words. He asked, with great bravado, that those who read him read his words out loud, and preferably by yourself. Now that, when I first read that, I thought, this man is stark raving mad. He is so fixated on himself. I mean, anybody author to recommend that to somebody is nuts. But I think he's right now. Maybe because I've gone down the hole, but the rabbit hole. But I think he's right. Because that's part of the difficulty of him. The reading of him, you'll see, his writings are very turgid. That's why I decided that this has to be a workshop. We have to have the material in front of our face, because if you just hear a line, unless you're a monumental intellect, that probably wouldn't even help. But if you hear a line, it just won't register, I think. You have to see it. And almost then take these little scraps that you'll get home with you and to your room and read them out loud. But anyway, that's another thing that makes him weird. See, he comes and goes. You've got to have a certain kind of a literary type, I guess, who will put up with those kind of shenanigans. A lot of people find him to be just so opaque, he's not worth the trouble. He's not worth the trouble. We are at a great advantage now since 1978, where Howard and Edna Hong have finally completed the translation of the journals. We've got 7 volumes. Those 4,000 pages are on. And the journals are much more readable than the authored books, the published books. So a lot of the stuff we're going to be looking at together is from the journals, excerpts from the journals. I'm going to say something now about the books that I'm going to be using, and then we'll look at some of the actual texts. The first book, starting tomorrow, we're going to look at this is the best. This is the best of the four, my money. This should be a devotional book of all Christians, as far as I'm concerned. Every Christian should own this book and read it many, many times. It's 2 little books here. They're written in 1851. One's called For Self-Examination, and the other one's called Judge for Yourselves. They're sermons. And there's nothing like them. There's nothing like these. These are astounding. And they have to do with what I call a spiritual corrective. What it's like to be spiritual as a Christian. What it's like to have the mind of Christ among you. That's what this book's about. These 2 little books are about. So we're going to spend 3 days this week on this little book, starting tomorrow. And then on Saturday, I was hoping we could do it on Friday, but they've canceled everything for the 4th of July, which pisses me off, frankly. But the second book we're going to look at is Fear and Trembling. We'll do that on Saturday, just one day on Fear and Trembling. And these books are in the bookstore, okay? The one in the bookstore is paperback, and it's maroon and black, so don't be looking for this one, this color. This is the way this one looks, though. You'll be able to find that, the blue one. And then next week, we'll be doing Training in Christianity and then Attack Upon Christendom. This one, too. Every Christian should have Judge for Yourself or Examination, but also every Christian, whether you're constipated or not, Charles Lutz, have that one. Right? Attack Upon Christendom. So those are the four books I'm going to be looking at. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to suggest at the beginning of the session, six passages in each one of these books, give you the page references, and then we'll start working on them. We may have got through them or not, but at least you'll have them there so you can work on them. And the books repay returned reading. You can go back and read them over and over again, and you'll see something new. Dare I say it's like reading Holy Writ. You go back to Holy Writ again and again, and you get something new each time. And these expositions of the Christian faith are like that. Are like that. Okay. I was expecting 10 people. So I don't have enough handouts here, so maybe you can share. No. Maybe I can get Bob Baker to do some printing, and if you guys are, you know, crazy enough to come back tomorrow, we'll have additional handouts. But I'd like to first hand out a copy of his writings. And that's the bibliography that I'm talking about. The secondary literature on Kierkegaard is, I'm told there's only one person living in the world who knows it, and that's Niels Funstrup at the Center for Kierkegaard Studies in Copenhagen. The literature is so vast, and it is so intercultural. Can you believe that there's a Korean edition? Chinese, Japanese editions, besides German, French, English, Danish, in which it was written, Italian, Spanish. And these just translations started happening virtually in 1940. So in a matter of 40 years, the stuff is really... I also like to hand out a syllabus. This is just the books that I've already told you we're going to be looking at and the sequence with other handouts listed there. And then I'd like to put before us... That's right. A guy up at Waterloo, I think. Alistair... No, not Alistair Cook. I can't remember his last name. McKinnon. Alistair McKinnon is the one who put that together. And at Waterloo... No, at Winnipeg. It's at Winnipeg. University of Winnipeg in Canada. There's a Kierkegaard library. And then the third Kierkegaard library everybody knows about, right? At St. Olaf. Okay. So there's three of them throughout the world. This is my little Kierkegaard brief, which for me is kind of a personal introduction to Kierkegaard. So I'd like to read some of these passages through with you once they're handed out. These are kind of the first sample. It's kind of a Kierkegaard sample. In it we have one of his most famous prayers. In it we have one of his most self-revealing letters to his confidant, Bosin, Emil Bosin, on what he was going to try to do with his life. And then some of his lovely statements about his task. No, you're not supposed to read ahead. Got to read this stuff out loud. SK is Søren Kierkegaard. He goes by SK. And these are all line drawings done of him. His biographer, Walter Lowry, says that the bottom one is the most representative line drawing of him. And this was taken of him as a student at the University of Copenhagen by a cousin, did that line drawing. And the others were, two of the others were done by family relatives. The one with the broad-rimmed hat was not done by a relative. That's done by H.P. Hansen in the late 19th century. He never knew Kierkegaard, but it was just from stories he'd heard about him walking around town in his broad-rimmed hat. Yeah, let's just read these together, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about him as we go. The first journal entry there from 1847, I put in as my rejoinder to those who call him a melancholy Dane. Kierkegaard, more than anyone I know, knew the joy of being a Christian. If this is properly interpreted, every man who truly wants to relate himself to God and be intimate with him really has only one task, to rejoice always. To rejoice always. And the melancholy comes in. I mean, if you're going to rejoice always, then you can't rejoice in the things that are fleeting, because it would be impossible to rejoice always if the basis for your joy is that which is fleeting, like the pension fund. Like your health, your money. What brings you joy? Fistful of 20s? Thousands of dollars in your savings account? Well, that comes and goes, my friends. If you're going to rejoice always, it has to be based on something which is not fleeting. And for Kierkegaard, it was the death and resurrection of Jesus. Okay. So one task the Christian has is to rejoice always. I would guess that most people that have had an introduction to Kierkegaard in college or something would be surprised he ever wrote that. Right? Because we know better his second statement here. What our age needs is pathos. That's suffering. Just as scurvy needs green vegetables. Our time needs pathos or suffering. But truly, the work of boring an artesian well cannot be more artful than all my dialectical reckoning of the comic, the pathos filled, and the passionate in order to get, if possible, a beneficial, pathos-filled breeze blowing. That's what he wants to do. Get a beneficial, pathos-filled breeze blowing. He wants us to learn again what it's like to suffer. But not so we can wallow in our disgust and wallow in our sorrow. It has to be a beneficial, pathos-filled breeze blowing. And he sees it not to have a sorry, sour end, but it will function like a blowing breeze. See? Very peculiar. Say, a pathos-filled life cannot have the refreshment of a blowing breeze. But for Kierkegaard, he was convinced it's the only thing that can bring that kind of refreshment. Now, his method that he employs in trying to do this is revealed, I think, that 1851 statement. When worldly shrewdness, that is, worldly reflection, is the particular evil, all tactics must become indirect. He sees the problem of the modern world and the church as one mired in shrewdness. You know what that's like? That's like being able to deflect all the hard sayings of Jesus. That's what the shrewdness is. You give me any text, and I can duck it. Give you any text, and you can duck it. Because we have developed in the modern world a shrewdness about us. We say Ronald Reagan is the Teflon president. We are Teflon Christians. Nothing sticks to us. So Kierkegaard had to figure out a way to make things stick to us. And all he wants to get to stick to you is Jesus. So he tries to figure out a way, and he uses this method of indirection. His indirect method. And this is done through humor, it's done through pseudonyms, it's done through all kinds of strange literary devices. Okay, so that's one thing you have to know about him, the method that he employs is this indirect method. And he wants to avoid efforts at becoming too rational in trying to end up explaining things away. So he had this well-known statement among students of Kierkegaard: when a lark wants to fart like an elephant, it has to blow up. That's blow up, kaboom! Right? And in the same way, all scholarly theology must blow up, because it is wanted to be the supreme wisdom instead of remaining what it is, an unassuming triviality. So he has an attack upon the rational explanation and understanding of the Christian faith. He wants the Christian faith instead to be something which he termed more existential, having to do with the very existence of the individual. He said, through all the examination of questions and answers that have been provided for scholars, one little question has been overlooked. And the question is, what does it mean to exist as a human being? We've dodged that question. We've dodged it. And I want to bring that question back and then hear what the New Testament voice is about how we are to live, how we are to exist as a human being. You have a tendency to get all worked up in the scholarly apparatus, in the theological explanations and disputations. Instead, the whole thing has to drive right to the point of what is it for us today to exist as a human being. Now, for him, his mentor was Martin Luther. He loved Luther. He loved him. More than any other, it was Luther. Kierkegaard, I say, is the great student, the great 20th century student who's come to the 20th century, this is right, of Martin Luther. So what Edna Hong has done in her little book, Gate of Grace, where she has Luther and Kierkegaard talking to each other, is right on the money. Because Kierkegaard brings Luther into the 20th century, I believe. Look what he says about, oh, Luther is still the master of us all. He's commenting there on a sermon that he just loved of Luther's. He says, next to the New Testament, that's a euphemism for Jesus. Next to Jesus, Luther is the truest figure. So while he loved Luther, he loved him to his grave. He also had some serious misgivings about him. His chief misgiving about Luther was he wasn't murdered. Luther's biggest failing was he wasn't shot through the head like Martin Luther King Jr. was. Because all true reformers of the church must be murdered. Now, how does Kierkegaard know that? How does he know that all true reformers of the church must be murdered? Because Jesus was. And that's it. That's his only evidence. Because Jesus was. He works this whole thing out in his book on works of love, Kierkegaard's book, Works of Love, where he says, if you love, you'll be hated.
Would it follow then that he has to be resurrected?
Oh, yes. Yes, it would follow. Yes. And that's very strong, you know, an undeniable element of the Christian faith is faith in the resurrection. If we're not raised, then all's for naught. You know, 1 Corinthians 15. But the thing is, you've got to be rejected by the world in which you live. Because this isn't the kingdom of God. In my little neighborhood, our Missouri Synod neighbors, two blocks away, have on their reader board little ditties all the time. And this week their ditty was, our native land is God's kingdom. Well, not only is our native land not God's kingdom, but nothing on this earth is God's kingdom. Nothing in this universe is God's kingdom. So if the word comes crystal clear through a reformer, that one must be shut up. That one must be stopped. And so we'll look at this passage later in the week.
Ron, yes. Can you read that as being quite a
subversive? Yes, but it's this land. Yes, it's not a subversive statement.
Just wanted to put the best
construction. Yes, candidate for bishop over there. Wanted to put the best construction up there. But, so Luther's primary problem was that he wasn't murdered. Kierkegaard says one of the worst pages in the history of the church is the story about Luther sitting around in his old age, the table talks, and all the students picking up the crumbs. That's not the life of a reformer. Should die in ignominy. He didn't die in ignominy. Died as a hero. Historians and biographers tell me that there isn't a figure in the history of the Western world that was as carefully documented during his life as Martin Luther was. It's like everybody knew that all kinds of biographies were going to be written about this guy. So they wrote down everything they could about him during his life. He was a hero. True reformer of the church, not a hero. He's a martyr. A martyr. And when you eliminate martyrdom from the church, Kierkegaard says, you've cut the nerve. That's it. It's over. So even though he loved Luther, he had these questions about him. Here's one that I include from the year before he died, before Kierkegaard died, 1854. Luther ought to have let it be known that he reduced Christianity. Now look at this. Furthermore, he ought to have made it known that his argument, otherwise we despair, Luther has it all the time. And when does he have it? He has it when there's the strident call to discipleship that you can never measure up to. He reduces Christianity, he eliminates that strident call, and his argument, we made it be known that his argument, otherwise we must be spared, is actually arguing from the human side. In Kierkegaard's book, For Self-Examination, he talks about, I'm talking about a very arduous way of being a Christian in this world. And he makes two, we'll look at those tomorrow, but he says, grace is primary, but there's a response to grace, and it can't in any way dilute the gift of grace, but there's this life of discipleship. And then he gets into this life of discipleship, and at the end he says, now some of you who are tired may say, just give me the grace. I'm too tired. And to you, I say, you need to suffer more. You need to suffer more if you think you're too tired. And then Kierkegaard said, who would be so cruel to say that? He said, the New Testament would be so cruel as to say that. I interviewed for a job back at Luther Seminary first this month, and I was sitting there with the systematic theology department and going through this stuff. And Lloyd Spensby, the president of the school, is sitting right there, and he goes, but Ron, I'm too tired. Lloyd sleeps two hours a day, and he's working everything in the world. He said, I'm just too tired. I need a word of comfort. I said, Lloyd, you're not suffering enough.
Hard at the job.
You're not suffering enough. That's the Kierkegaardian word. See? That's the Kierkegaardian word. Don't hide. We're shrewd, you see. We're all looking for a place to hide, to deflect the word that comes to us. Okay, so Luther is very important, but he had that misgiving about him. The next one, generally speaking, there's no doubt. There no doubt will be no one in eternity who will be judged as severely, there you've got it, as the pastors. He's very worried about the pastors. From the point of view of eternity, they are what public prostitutes are in temporality. Preachers. Preachers want everybody to feel good so that the money keeps coming in. Preachers want everyone to be happy so that the church grows and so that, I tell my folks in our church, what we need are fewer members so that each one of us will have to give more. He said, we need more members. Then we'll get more money. Then we'll be able to do more. He said, we need fewer members. So it'll be harder on us because none of us are giving till it hurts. Preachers want to be the nice guy or the nice gal. They don't want to say the hard word. They don't want to be rejected. And when pastors feel they're being rejected, it's time to leave. Right? I've been here 3 years. That's the rule of thumb. It's time to go. They're starting to find out who I am. They're going to get pissed off. Time to move on. sense of living through the... So you see, preachers are prostitutes. Kierkegaard. Then this prayer of his that's so, it's reprinted all over the place. You heavenly powers, you who undergird the good, you heavenly hosts, help me to raise my voice so that it can, if possible, be heard over the whole world. I have only one word to say, but if I am granted the power to say this one word or this one sentence in such a way that it might establish itself firmly and never be forgotten, my choice is made. I have it. I would say our Lord Jesus Christ was a nobody. Remember that. Christendom. A nobody. Am I a nobody? No. I make $45,000 a year. I'm landed gentry. And I speak for Jesus. Kierkegaard says, that makes me vomit. Remember Christendom. Jesus Christ was a nobody. Okay. And then this line from his letter. It's 1838. This is right when the authorship gets going. I need a voice as piercing as the glance of Lynceus, the bobcat, mythic bobcat. I need a voice as piercing as the glance, Lynceus, as terrifying as the groan of the giants, as sustained as a sound of nature, extending in range from the deepest bass to the most melting high notes, and modulated from the most solemn, silent whisper to the fire-spouting energy of rage. That is what I need in order to breathe. To give voice to what is on my mind. To make the viscera of both anger and sympathy tremble. I did a class on this in Renton in January. And I said, that is the writing of a genius or a madman. And one of the women in the class says, there's another option. It's the words of a composer. She's a composer. That's the word of a composer, an artist, that yearning.
Was he campaigning for martyrdom?
For himself or for others?
For himself.
No.
I mean, you know, he says that's the ultimate necessity.
For a reformer.
And certainly he was... called himself a reformer by his actions and mm-hmm. he's filling with the church. What else must you do to become a martyr?
Mm-hmm. Well, he had kind of a funny understanding of how he was a martyr, and we'll look at that later, but it wasn't something he campaigned for. He saw himself as one without authority. He had no authority.
What does viscera mean?
The body, kind of the basic human flesh. The anger that comes from that and the sympathy. Make that tremble. You know, it's bringing the green vegetables to the scurvy. This pathos that needs to just get the life invigorated in us again. That's kind of his. Now I've got two other little ditties want to hand out. One is on the kind of pastors he thinks we need. And that's how this was built, pastors in the crowd. So I want to hand that out. And then there's one on what it is to be a spiritual person. What kind of pastors are needed? Pastors are what will be needed, all right. Pastors who possessing the desirable scientific scholarly education, yet in contrast to the scientific game of counting, our practice in what could be called spiritual guerrilla skirmishing. In doing battle, not so much with scholarly scientific attacks and problems as with the human passions. Pastors who are able to split up the crowd and turn it into individuals. Pastors who are disciplined and educated and are prepared to obey and to suffer so that they would be able to mitigate, admonish, build up, move, but also to constrain, not with force, anything but, no, constrained by their own obedience and above all patiently to suffer all the rudeness of the sick without being disturbed. No more than the physician is disturbed by the patient's abusive language and kicks during the operation, for the generation is sick. spiritually sick, sick unto death. That's what we need, he says. Pastors like that. Now one on what a pastor is doing that is to nurture the mind of Christ among us. The spiritual side of existence, if you will. And here's his little ditty on what it is to be a spirit, to be spiritual. This was written around the time of Marx's Communist Manifesto. See if you can hear it in the background. That's a big debate on whether or not Kierkegaard actually read Marx. Just as production by machine is on a much larger scale and more accurate than by hand, so also generation after generation the state delivered an assortment of Christians, all with the factory stamp of the state. The Lutheran Standard. Don't you love that name? All with the factory stamp of the state. Each Christian an accurate copy of the others. So accurate that the heart of any manager of a factory must leap to see what matchless heights of accuracy the art has attained. But the main point in Christianity is that man is spirit, and spirit is diversity. Diversity per se. Christianity's infinitely sublime thought is that each Christian becomes a Christian by different ways and means. Always diversity, which is precisely what God wants. God, the detester of all mimicry, which indicates the absence of spirit, mimicry, who is inexhaustible in creating diversity. That God. That God. There is no Lutheran standard. That's what the pastor who breaks up the crowd, who tries to nurture the individuality of everyone, is doing, because that one is nurturing the spirit in all. I remember when I was at the seminary, I said, I'm sick and tired of being treated like a cow. I'm treated like a cow. We're all herded around. You go there. You go here. You're assigned there. You're assigned there. So why don't you ask us what we think we need? Huh? Well, there's two problems with that. First of all, Father knows best. And that seminary is a factory for reproducing clones. And the second problem with it was, and this is what one of my teachers told me just flat out, if we were to do that, Ron, there would be such a red tape snafu administratively that we'd never get out of it. And I said, then we need to close the seminary down. If the only justification for treating the students like cattle is because it's too administratively difficult to treat them like individuals, then it's time to close the blank, blank thing down. Too big. Spirit is diversity that detests mimicry. But it is utterly unmanageable, and it is extremely dangerous, and that's why pastors have chosen instead to be prostitutes. Well, you have some things in your hands, and I encourage you to look them over, think about them, read them. Read them out loud, not when your wife or husband are around. They'll think you've lost your mind. Maybe while you're in the bathroom. Yeah, while you're in the bathroom. Take these little slips with you and use them for reading. And then come back tomorrow and we'll talk more about these matters and related matters. And look in a little more detail on what this spiritual corrective amounts to for him. How many didn't get the handout so I know how short I was? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 20. The little ones. And, well, all of them. I had about the same number, I think. Okay. If this is all you can take, you know, and you don't, you can come back tomorrow and pick up the handouts and leave at the beginning. I'll have some extra. Bob, do we have, can you make a few extras for me? Okay, we'll have a few extras back there on the... on the counter, and you can pick those up. But there'll be more next week. I have 14 of these little slips that you could acquire over the 2 weeks if you're of that mind to do that. But and as we get along, go along here, there'll be less of my talking and more of reading the text and relating to the text. This was kind of your first, get some feel on how we're going to operate. But I really am serious about it being a workshop. Okay. So tomorrow I'll hand all the stuff out at the beginning, and we'll just open up the book and start looking at stuff. Okay. So it'll be more informal that way. Thank you for your patience. First times are difficult, and I feel that I talk way too much, but that's a start, okay? And the next days, there'll be much more discussion. Okay. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I mean, you have such a soothing voice. Really.
Oh, does
it? Yes, we'll be live.
Good.
Are you going to have more material tomorrow?
Yes, I'll have more copies.
Okay, I'm working, so this means I'm not going to be here every day.
Okay.
But I know we can have the tapes. And
I'll have the handouts, yeah.
Okay, so.
You can. Let's see, wonder how we can do that. The days that you come, tell me. Say I wasn't here yesterday. Can you give me the stuff from yesterday?
Okay.
All right.
Fine.
Like
fine.
That?
Fine. And the books are in the bookstore.
In the bookstore. Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Fine.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. We're leaving today.
Oh. Well. Okay.
Just, yeah.
There are about 10 of us that were here today that are leaving.
Oh.
So if the group is smaller, about it's not because we didn't get here more.
Yeah, that's all right.
Very
exciting. Yeah. Yeah. I wish you could.
What did you just? Are you leaving West Seattle?
No.
Oh, you're staying there.
Oh, yeah.
I got to stay for all the fights, you know.
Where is your church? We live north of Seattle.
Oh, is that right?
We go church visiting. Yeah.
Well,
we're right on California.
Well, you're the one
just north of the church. Me in West Seattle.
Yeah, I know where
just north.
Is.
You know where Holy Rosary Church is, the big tower?
Yeah.
Come right across the street.
I don't know.
Sandstone building on the corner there.
Well, you come into the city, we may just stop in and see you.
Yeah, good.
Right.
Thank you.
We're going to get the lunch. I know, but I was interested in that.
Are these the books?
Yeah, those are the books, yeah.
The one about indirectness.
Yeah.
Reading all of these.
What
he has. It was interesting because he used his description of it. He was
So
all last week we're talking
about
how we interface.
But I don't know how many things she used.
Is he suggesting directness? Okay, there's 20 minutes left. And you listen to government officials speak today. What were you saying? But it's their lies,
their shrewdness.
It's the shrewdness, that's it. So in order to counter the shrewdness, he said to be indirect.
Well, he has, let me give you the one, he's got the one ditty on this.
That's what I'm struggling with right now with my own personal, being manipulative, indirect, that kind of thing. When,
he has a direct statement for that. Here, look at this. I never deny directly what a man says about himself. Ronald Reagan, you're a liar. You're a crook. You're a son of a bitch. And you don't say that. The usual thing is for someone to make some inflated statement about himself, Reagan, and then be told that it's a lie, a delusion, and then there's a quarrel.
Mm-hmm.
I do not do things like that. No, when a man says something like that, I answer, if you yourself say so, then I believe it. It's the indirect tendency. Then I take his statement and I think it through to all of its existential consequences. I confront him with them. One or two things happen. Either he more or less accepts them, and then there is more or less truth in him,
mm-hmm.
or he does not accept them, and then he has judged himself.
Mm-hmm.
I judge no one. But this brings things into the open. So I think that's the way you got to deal with these guys.